Hey everyone, this is Clint Locklear with Trapping Radio, and today we're going to do kind of a rewind, I guess you would say. A really good friend of mine, which is also a sponsor here on Trapping Radio, Jeff Dunlap, his father passed away. And I thought it might be kind of I really don't know what to call it, but it would be good to hear him one last time on the Trapping Radio. So that's what I decided that we will do. It's this was originally Trapping Radio 185, and it'll be the one that you hear today. And I want to say a few things. I was talking to a good friend of mine the other day, and it was Albert Simpson. Albert is the one that has taken over a lot of the stuff, Texas stuff, with me as my lure business has grown and different things. And his nickname is Old School. He's also done some interviews on here that you can listen to. And he was asking me if I've heard from Jeff, because if you can imagine, it kind of happened unexpectedly, and his dad lives in Alaska, and you had to get airplane tickets and funeral arrangements and get family together and all that type stuff. So I haven't really talked to Jeff since he called me the day of and talked to me. But Albert heard about it, probably from Facebook or something. And he was talking about how he used to buy fox lure from him, and what of a nice guy and stuff that Jeff's dad was. Now, I want to say something of... I've never met Jeff's dad, but I can tell you from stories from Jeff that there were some serious good qualities about him. And one of the main ways that I know that there was good qualities there is because the man that he raised was Jeff. And when you meet another person that is loyal like Jeff is to his friends, and intelligent the way Jeff is, and creative and as helpful as Jeff is to other people, you know their father did something right. So even though I never got to meet him, I have met him in a way through Jeff. And I just thought it would be an interesting thing for us to do, to listen to it. It was one I was going to listen to anyway, just because, you know, stuff like that's on my mind when this goes on. I do want to, right before we get started though, just go ahead and thank all the sponsors, not just Jeff, even though he is a sponsor, Trapping Radio, F&T up in Michigan, Wildlife Control Supplies out of Connecticut, Oki Cable and Trap out of Oklahoma, and then Weebly Knives out of South Dakota. I just want to go ahead and say thanks to all of them. And if you've never heard this interview before, it is, from what I remember of it, I really, really enjoyed it. And I just think it's a kind of a timely thing to do to honor a trapper that's went to a different trapping grounds. So let's go ahead and get started with Jeff interviewing his own father.
All right. Well, I got my Mr. Jeff Dunlap. I got my dad on the phone. We're going to try and do an interview. He's up to North Pole, Alaska. And so we're going to record this over the phone. I wish I was up there to be able to record him in person, but it's not possible, especially being in the fall and just about ready to start trapping. So, you there, Dad?
Yeah, I'm here.
He just got done at my cousin's football game up there. They won 65-0. So he's all pumped up, ready to do this interview. A lot of this stuff, I'll know, you know, what you've done in your life and stuff, but just to kind of give other people an idea, when did you start trapping? At what age? Or
seventh grade, about 13 years old. My mom bought me, 2 dozen used number one long spring traps for my birthday.
Did you want to trap before that, or did?
Oh yeah, I wanted to trap. I always read stories about Mountain Man and Daniel Boone and stuff like that. But nobody in my family ever trapped.
So
They all hunted, but they didn't trap.
So you, when you got those traps, I mean, did you have success right away, or did it, you know, take a
while? Well, I didn't know anything about trapping, and there was a creek named Willow Creek. It was about a mile and a half from where we lived, and me and a friend of mine, Gerald Hauser, we would walk down there, and we just set traps in every hole that we found, and we didn't know nothing about, you know, muskrats, what they were. We were trying to catch. We were just trying to catch something, and the first year we caught one muskrat, and we took it home, and we didn't know how to skin it, and there was a guy down the road that knew, had done some trapping. He was an older guy when he was younger. We took it down there, and he showed us how to skin it, and he made us a stretcher out of a shingle, a cedar shingle, and we put it on took it home and put it in the garage, and we kept it. We didn't know any place to sell it, so we had it all year long. We used to, even in the summertime, we'd go out there, and we had the traps hanging there, and we'd go out and sit and look at the muskrat and making plans, and we'd go down to that Willow Creek and look around and stuff, and in the summertime, we saw a mink down there. We didn't. And so that we decided we were gonna be mink trappers. So the next year we set traps again in all the holes, and we caught a couple more muskrats. And but then a guy told us about that in town there was a fur buyer. It's the guy that would buy them. So we went. We got his dad to take us in there. And we went in there, and the fur buyer's name was Cooking Ham, and he was an older gentleman, and he hunted mink with a dog, and at that time, the only furs that were worth any money were muskrats and mink, and the long-haired furs weren't in at that time, and we had, I think it was about a half a dozen muskrats, and when we went in there, there was all this fur laying around, these fur, and it had, you know, the smell of a fur shed. That was the first time. I've never forgot that smell of going to that fur buyer, and that the smell just walking in there and smelling that and talking to him, and he had traps for sale, and we traded him those muskrats for I don't remember exactly. I think it was two dozen number one Lincoln lambs. So now we had like almost four dozen traps. And when we went back down to that Willow Creek, there on about a half a mile stretch of that Willow Creek, every hole had we put a trap in it. And we caught a few more muskrats that year, and we got, you know, it was just going on from there, you know.
What year was that, do you think? That was like 1955, the early 60s?
Oh, that was, I don't know, let's see, that would have, oh, crap, I don't know, I can't think of what I'm going to say. Well, let's see, probably, 1958, something like that.
Huh. They didn't even have the body grips back then, so, I mean, you know, that would have been easier if you guys would have started with something like that, but...
No, there was no conibears at that time. It was all lake hole traps.
Huh. What was, like, on the muskrats, what was the price on, and like, muskrats or mink? Because you said long hair fur wasn't in. Because I remember you telling me before, like, in the...
It was like 75 cents, I think, as far as I can remember.
So
I don't remember muskrats getting over a dollar until in the 60s.
Huh.
I remember I was in the 60s. It was in the late 60s when muskrats went over a dollar, if I can remember right. But I remember everybody thought that was a big deal when muskrats went over a dollar.
Huh. Now talking about it, 75 cents a dollar don't seem like much, but that was real money back then.
Yeah, but you could buy dozens, like, of those. We bought those Blake and Lamb traps that we bought. I think they were only like $3.50 a dozen or something.
Ah, that'd been awesome to get that that deal now.
Yeah.
They well, then you started out with Gerald trapping. You got your first muskrat, and then you did all that you talked about. But then then where did it progress from there? I mean, did you because you would have been going into high school and stuff. I mean, did you keep trapping right on through high school?
Well, yeah. When the area where we lived at, there was a chain of lakes. I went to a school called Michigan Center, and there was a chain of lakes and down through there. And there was a lot of marsh. And a lot of the guys in high school at that time, there was a lot of guys that trapped and hunted ducks, and they were all outdoors people. And there was we had a lot of opportunity to set traps and stuff. And at school, everybody was always talking about what they caught and stuff. And when somebody caught a mink, that was a big deal. And there was a place called O'Brien's Trading Post. It was right on the water in Michigan Center there. It wasn't that far from the high school, and we used to go over there at lunchtime. Roy O'Brien was the guy that owned it. And we'd go in there, and he had, at that time, Case made, was the only ones that made improved muskrat jackknives. And they had real foreign handles on them. And we'd go in there, and there'd be a half a dozen of us. We'd go in there, and we asked him if we could look at the knife, and I think he had one that he kept that he showed us every time, and he never ever told us no, and he'd give us a knife, and we'd look at it and open it and close it. None of us, I think it was like $6 for the knife, and none of us had $6, but, there was a couple guys that had one that they got it for a present. And I remember the first time that I had enough money and I went over there and bought one of those improved muskrat knives. That was a big deal. And at that time, everybody carried a jackknife to school. Nobody ever talked about stabbing somebody. If you got in a fight, it was with fists.
Yeah.
Nobody ever said nothing. I remember it. That take a jackknife out, show it to somebody in school, nobody ever said nothing.
No, even when I was in school, carrying a jackknife wasn't a big deal. I mean, that was in the 80s, so.
Yeah.
But they, it's weird how things have changed these days. It's like I sell them jackknives at the conventions, like you're talking about, all you and your friends went in there and looked at the jackknives and wanted one and couldn't get one, because $6 was quite a bit. Now kids will walk up there, and I mean, they buy $20 knives all day long.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's weird how things, have changed. I mean, some for the better, but, not at all. But, when you got done, going over there looking at the knives and all that, what was the, because, you ended up going, professional trapper, working in the shop and stuff, and how did it progress from that point to where you decided that, you were going to just, have our whole family go into that?
Oh, boy, there's a lot of time in between,
When you started to be able to, you were improving, like right before the, like say the Red Fox prices came up, you told me about, you and my mom riding down the road and, looking for tracks and just trying to figure out the locations and stuff like that.
There was a bounty on Red Fox in Michigan. I don't remember the exact year. I think it was like 64, 65 that they took the bounty off of Red Fox. It was $5. And guys used to, before that, they would den trap, and they'd just mostly trap the pups. They didn't trap in the fall. And the fur wasn't worth anything. And then they took the bounty off, and then nobody trapped them. And there was really an influx of a lot of Red Fox in the 60s. and then there was about, I think it was 67, that there was a guy from La Crosse, Wisconsin, that used to come to Michigan buying fur, and he used to come to a guy's place named Wes Grant, and he would, he called and said that he was going to be paying $4.50 for Red Fox, and so we made a bunch. Nobody knew, even knew, really knew how to even skin one, but we got some board and made some stretchers, and I used them stretchers for as long as I was trapping them wooden stretchers. Huh. And we trapped fox that year, and that it was all after work trapping, and on weekends, and mostly it was in October, and I believe that I caught 123 fox that year. And with the one we went to sell them, we ended up getting $4 for them.
Huh.
But that was a lot of money, and we used that money for a down payment on a house.
Hmm.
And, which was a quite a help.
Is being able to go out and produce that fur like that and get the money? I mean, is that what brought you to the point of where, because you told me that they had laid you off, and why don't you tell that story about when you made the decision that you were done working for somebody else, and after that?
I'd worked in a shop since I got out of high school. I was a journeyman tool and die maker, but I didn't mind doing the work. I just hated going there, and I was working in a shop, and they laid me off, and it was in the spring, and so I had to really scramble. At that time, I just bought another house, and I had two house payments to make, and it was a tough time, but I'd made up my mind, and the price of fur was going up every year, and red fox were worth about $12. The year before that, and they were talking about them being higher than that, and so they, about the time when I got, it was in October, I was going to go up north of us and trap in the zone two for 3 or 4 weeks before I started trapping in the southern part of the state where I lived. And about that time, they called me back to work, and I had made all the plans and had all this lined up and stuff, and I talked it over with your mother, and we decided that, I could get a job later on if I had to, but we decided that I was going to just trap full time, and we wanted to move up north anyway. That was our plan for years. So I went trapping, and it worked out, and we caught a bunch of fur. And when we sold the fox, and that year the fox, I think that was about 1973, and the fox, I think we got $48 for them.
Hmm.
And that was the first year that I ever remember getting any amount of money for coon. Nobody fleshed a stretched coon. They just skinned them or sold them in the carcass. And mostly the coon were produced by coon hunters, and because coon had never been worth much. And they that year, I remember that for some reason it stuck in my mind. It was $12 got for coon just skinned out.
Huh. And that was like, that's when it started taking a rise at that point.
Yeah, and it kind of just went from there up to where it bottomed out in the 80s.
Hmm. The
during that period of time, because a lot of people won't know, but my dad bought fur, you know, throughout his trapping, you know, time when he was trapping and stuff. Were you buying fur during that period of time, or?
I started buying fur at, it was 1974.
So just after when the fur started taking a bump up, then, you know, you were starting to buy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we was at a fur sale, and Jim Jewell and I, who I was trapping with at that time, we were at a fur sale, and a guy named Sam Salzman from New York City approached Jim and asked him if he knew anybody that was interested in buying fur in the area. He was looking for somebody who were a dealer. Somehow or another, we got hooked up into that, and that's quite a story in itself of how we got into the fur business.
Yeah, it probably was exciting at the time, though, you know, seeing some opportunity to, you know, make some money and do something else that you wanted to do.
It was an adventure, that's for sure.
In 1973, you know, you said it was, they were four, you know, Fox had took a bump up to $48. We moved up north in northern Michigan it was 1977. What year did the Red Fox take that big bump up? You know, where they, you talk to the, a lot of guys, you know, the old guys that used to trap during that period, and they, you know, they talk about, you know, $150 fox. I mean, what period?
No, that never happened. I never seen a $150 fox. The one year the fox got up to, it was in the real price at the one weekend, as far as I know, in Michigan, at two fur sales, the fur sale in Jackson and the fur sale in Marshall, the fox got in the 90s, and a few went to $100, the trapper lots. But the real market was about $75 to $80.
Mm-hmm. So, about like you've always told me, that, you know, what happens at a fur sale is not the market, you know, and that's basically what happened there.
No. Yeah. No. I see at that fur sale there was a guy named Joe Smith who was a good fox trapper, and he had around 80, 90 red fox, and his lot number come up, and he was drunk, and he was offered $94 for those fox, and he turned it down. He said he wanted $100, and nobody could believe that he turned $94 down. And he says, "I want $100, or I won't sell them." Like, you know, there's no place else in the world you're going to get $94. Well, at the end of the fur sale, they'll let you run your fur through, but nobody ever mounted anything. So he waited all day long. He waited and run them fox back through, and these two guys, for, I don't know why, but these two guys, fur buyers got to arguing about them fox, or they were mad about something. Anyway, he got $101 for them fox. He said, I never forget it. He says, Joe stood up there and he had this great big fur coat on. He says, "I knew I was right."
I remember bits and pieces of some of them fur sales, like, you know, my mom and Kathy Hauser working, you know, selling the coffee and all that stuff.
They sold refreshments.
And I remember standing up in front with you. Me and Jerry Hauser had caught those rats at his aunt's or uncle's or whatever. And I remember them offering me $12, and I said, you remember, I says, "Nope, I won't sell." And you said, "Oh, man, you better sell, because that's $12 a piece, not $12 for all of them." So,
yeah, you thought it was for all of them.
Yeah, I wasn't even going to be cheated back then. So, and that was.
When you decided to
move us north, you know, because where we moved from was about, it was southern Michigan where we were, you know, and we moved 250 miles or so north on Lake Huron up in northern Michigan.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when you moved up there, you know, because, I mean, the fur price was on the rise. You know, you were buying fur down there and being successful at it. You know, was it all peaches and cream when you got up to Alpena? You know, because, I mean,
no.
I was just starting to set the third grade when we got there.
No, it was quite an adventure to move and not knowing anybody. And when we first moved up there, it was, because everything was, at that time, was land trapping. And when I went around and started trying to get permission on farms and stuff, there was like, I went like 3 days and never got one farm to trap. I was pretty discouraged, you know, the first year. I picked around and I finally ended up getting some farms, and I had trapped over toward the west before, on the federal land. Yeah, from when I lived downstate, I'd come up and trap on the federal land, but I never trapped in the farm country. Where we moved to, there's a strip of farms along the coast there, but there was quite a few guys that had lived trapped there for a long period of time, and they were pretty good trappers, and they did a good job. But over the years, we acquired a pretty good bunch of farms to trap on and stuff. But first year was pretty tough. But and then buying fur, it was like total. You as a new guy, and the people up in that area were pretty clandish, and they really didn't want us there. And, you know, it took us about 20 years, then they figured that we were natives, I guess.
Yeah, I remember one time during that period of time when you were going out and you couldn't get any farms to trap on, because the area we moved to, not all, but it was a lot of German Poles and Russian Poles, and, you know, in high school I had a buddy that he had to go and ask, it was Jeff, he had to go and ask his mom, because everybody was related there, and he had to ask his mom if it was his cousin or not, if he could date this one girl in particular I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
So it was it was real clannish, like my dad said. But I remember you going out and getting permission, and Sam Bartz called. You got permission from one farm in all them days, and I remember him calling. You hadn't even got home yet, and he already said that he wasn't going to let you trap there. So, you know.
Yeah, he changed his mind, yeah.
So, you know, but, I mean, that goes back to where a lot of these guys, you know, with the prices, you know, that you're getting for everybody, you know, they talk about the old days like it was all, you know, biscuits and gravy, but, you know, just because the prices were high, I mean, made a lot of the things more difficult, you know, on getting on places. I mean, it wasn't where everything was just opened up and, you know, in that.
Well, there was one time that we usually started when we was trapping with your uncle, who was my brother-in-law, Charlie Lane, and he was pretty good at talking to farmers. He grew up on farms, so he did most of the getting the permission on the farms, and he went out on in August and started getting permission, and he won one Sunday, I think it was, he went out and there was a guy mowing hay, and he went out to the guy in the tractor, and the guy stopped, and as he was walking up there, he says, "I sure hope you ain't gonna ask to trap. And he says, "Well, as a matter of fact, it was." He says, "Well, you're the third guy today."
And I mean, most of them farms you stop, them same farms you're talking about down in there, I mean, you stop there now, and, you know, they haven't had anybody stop and ask about trapping, you know.
Well, it's totally different, because that strip down through there at that time, there was no coyotes in that farm country. It was all red fox.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had to go over into the rough country, into the federal and state ground, and then you ran into coyotes if you wanted to trap coyotes. The first year, or the second year that I lived there, is we caught around 120 30-some, I don't remember exactly something, it was over 130-some fox, red fox, and never caught a coyote. Huh. And in that same country now, you'd be lucky probably to catch a fox.
Yeah.
If you did, it would be a gray fox. And there was no gray fox, and there was no possums there neither. Where we lived north of the Isabel River, and there was no possums there. Those people up there had never seen a possum.
No.
And then one year we started on the other side, the south side of the river, you started catching possums, and then the next year, 30 miles north of that river, we was catching possums. I mean, quite a few. We probably caught probably 25, 30 possums that year.
Huh.
And that little dinky things, real small possums.
Yeah, they're still like that up here.
there was, a lot of skunks.
Well, there ain't no shortage of possums here now, I can tell you. But, so, when you were trapping, I know the answer, but just so the people, get kind of a, feel about how you did it. Did you mostly during your life, trap alone, or did you, take a partner on? Did you take a partner on when it, benefited you?
Well, different times. When we lived in the southern part of the state, I mostly trapped by myself, and then when I was first moved up north, I. The first couple years I trapped by myself, and then my brother-in-law Charlie Lane, he had never trapped, but he kind of took a shine to it, and he kind of he was riding around with me all the time and helping me, and he started wanting to set some traps. He set some traps one year by himself, and he caught, I don't know, 12, 15 fox, and then the next year, I said, I told him, I said, if you go out and get, I don't remember what it was, like 50 farms, I said, we'll trap together. So he got pretty close to that many farms. I didn't think he'd ever get that many farms, but he did. And
I never heard that before. That's funny.
And some of them was only 10 acres, but I guess they were farms. But they counted on the quota, I guess, and we trapped together, and I showed him how to trap, and so that year I trapped with him, and basically I trapped with him ever since.
When you went out of state, I don't remember how old I was, maybe seven. It had been 71, 72, when you went, down south trapping. So I remember one time you brought me home a cavalry hat, and it had, the cross swords on the front. I still remember that hat. I don't even remember how old I was. It had been, kindergarten or first grade, maybe. But when you went down there a lot of times, and then, going to Alabama, Georgia, and even out to Arizona, you went with different guys. When you went down to the southern states, you've been down to Louisiana with me, but how was it different, in the late 60s, early 70s, trapping down south, in, say, Georgia, than what it is now?
Well, the first time that I ever went down trapping in the south was 68, and no, 69, because you was just born, and I went down there with a guy named Dick Smith, not the Richard Smith that wrote the book, but a different guy, and we went to Alabama, I was involved with the Southern Michigan Trappers Association. I was the president for a number of years, and through that, I met this Dick Smith, and and I was Earl Renshaw, who was the first president of the NTA. He was down in Alabama, and he called me up, and he says, "You better get your traps and get down here." He says, "There's all kinds of beaver," and he says, "The timber company's paying a $5 bounty on them."
Earl Renshaw is the one that called you?
Yeah, Earl Renshaw,
Just because a lot of the younger guys, most guys aren't, like even me, I don't know if it wasn't for you, but you know, you got to tell, you know, when this guy's calling you, you know, what kind of outfit he always said he wore and stuff.
Oh, yeah, well, Earl, he goes back, he was in World War I, and he would wear, he had a campaign, one of them campaign hats on at the Cavalry War, and he'd wear these blouse pants, and down there in Alabama, they called him the Colonel, and Earl was a big promoter. And he did some trapping, but he was more of a promoter than anything else. Mm-hmm. Earl, I can't believe that nobody ever wrote a book about him. He lived up in Ackerman, Michigan, and I used to go up there mink trapping and doing a little bit of coyote trapping, but mostly Dave Duncan and I went up there a couple of years and trapped mink up there, and we rented a cabin from him. And the guy that started the Southern Michigan Trappers Association, Dick McKibben and Ty McKibben, used to rent a cabin from him. He had three cabins, and we stayed there. And it was a place that you could plug in a freezer, and you know, it was a place to get in and out of the weather. And Earl would be over there banging on his typewriter all hours of the night. And He wrote a book against the state was trying to outlaw the bounty, and he wrote a book that was called Bounties No Bunk. And he didn't sell it, he gave it away. It was a little booklet. But anyway, he was the one that called me from down in Alabama, and he'd go down there in the wintertime to get out of the snow up in Ackerman, and he'd go down there, and he called me and said about all these beaver and stuff, and so I was talking to that Dick Smith, and he said he wanted to go, and I said, well, I'll go, and we gathered up a bunch of traps and headed down there, and we got down there, Earl had two other guys. He had a guy from Pennsylvania. His name was Paul Miller, and he was a Mennonite. I think they said it was his name, which pronounced the Bueller. And then there was a guy from Kansas that was there. And I don't remember his name, John something. But anyway, we commenced the trapping beaver, and it was quite an adventure.
And that was all footholds. What were they, like them number four jumps or something?
Well, yeah, we just used traps. You know, at that time we had a few conifers. Were just like people were trapping rats with 110s, and nobody. Nobody was really using 220s at that time. I don't even know if they was making 220s at that time. They might not even been making them. But the 330s, I had a few of those, but it was like just on the verge. People were just starting to learn how to set them. But there was a lot of beaver down there.
You trapped Georgia for what? Three or four years, or was it longer than that?
At least four years. Yeah, maybe five. I have to figure it out.
Because I can remember. Yeah. I don't. My thing is, I don't know if I remember going there, or if I just remember the story.
Yeah.
But when
you and your mom, the first year we went there. How I got started down there was there was a guy named that lived down by the Wajack, and his name was Dave Daisy, and the Daisies were big rat trappers, and I had taught him how to trap fox, and and somehow he got hooked up with some guy, some forester down in Georgia there, down by a place called Forsyth, it's just north of Macon, and he they wanted the beaver caught, and they thought they had 10,000 beaver. We went down there, and they really didn't have a lot of beaver. There really wasn't that many beaver, but they had a lot of gray fox and bobcats, and there was a lot more beaver in Alabama than in Georgia.
Yeah, but I can remember when we went. Like I said, I don't remember if I seen the video, you know, like the old home movies of the snow on the ground over there.
It was the first, when we went down there, because I told your mom we'd go and she could get out of the snow, and we went down there and it started snowing. It was the first time it snowed in 100 years down there. We were the first ones to ever trap beaver through the ice in Georgia, I think.
But then you went over to Alabama, and you went there for a
couple. I've been to Alabama before I went to Georgia.
Oh.
But then I went back to Alabama 2 or 3 different years after that.
Yeah, because I can remember going over to when I was in fifth grade. You took me down there, trap.
Yeah, it was down a little town called Butler. It was
over on the.
It was right on the border of Mississippi. It wasn't too far from Meridian, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. We trapped on the Tombigbee River.
Hmm. Yeah, and I know that you have a special place in your heart for the Tombigbee River, because when we come back from Louisiana, we'd always go by there so you could see it. So.
I had. Charlie and I had a lot of good times on that river. We caught a pile of beaver off that river.
Yeah.
There was a lot of little streams coming in it into it, and we caught a lot of beaver.
You guys, when you were setting on that, you were just mainly setting for beaver. You guys weren't trying to catch otter or coon or none of that stuff.
No, the license was $500. I think it's still that. An out of stater could trap beaver without a license. And the only other thing, you know, there was a lot of coon on that river, but at that time, I didn't know that much about southern coon. All I'd heard, you know, I knew they were small and stuff, and you know, not too many people wanted them at that time, or it seemed like. I don't really remember those, but we just trapped beaver.
Mm-hmm. But you know, I mean, you were trapping and making money, so that's, you know, the two main things.
I don't know if we made money, but we were trapping. That was the important part.
Yeah,
I remember the Duke. This was before they started making traps, and they had a fur buying station in this town where we stayed, and we went there. They come every 2 weeks, and we asked them if we went there and talked to them. They asked them if they bought beaver, and he said, "Yeah." And I asked him, "Well, how many will you take?" And he says, "I'll take all you got." He says, "It don't matter." I said, "You'll take all we got, huh?" He said, "Yeah." Well, we had three or four freezers that we brought with us, plus we rented some freezers. We went to a used place where they had freezers, and we just rented them from the guy and told him when we got done, he could have them back. And if we could plug them in there. So we had about 10, 12 freezers, and when we would sort them out, because down in the south, a lot of the beaver are really bit up.
Mm.
So the ones that were bit up, we put in one, we had them in one types of freezer and the other. So the ones that were bit up, we drug them out, and we hauled them over, because there was a guy that was down there named Bruce Bally, and he had a little Chevy Love, and you couldn't get another beaver in the back of that truck. And they were thought we hauled them over. I don't remember how many we had, but That guy didn't want no more. The Duke didn't want no more beaver.
Yeah, that's always a good thing when you can break them. I know you've had a lot of good times in the South. I've had, a lot of good times down there.
We've had some good times together in the South.
Yep, we have. But why did you make the decision to, because you end up going out to Arizona. I think you go out there with three different guys, three times. Well, then the last time you drug two derelicts along, me and Dennis.
Dennis. Oh, yeah.
But why did you make the decision to quit going down south? Because of fur prices, or you just, because you always, gravitate towards the land trapping more, so.
Well, I don't, I had heard all the stories about guys trapping out west and catching all these piles of fur and stuff, and I knew a guy that lived in southern Michigan, and he went out to Phoenix on a vacation the year before, and he spent some time just wandering around in the desert, out there wandering around, and he was telling about all the coyote tracks. But what he didn't realize at the time, them coyote tracks were probably 2 months old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember the first wash.
But anyway,
I remember the first wash I walked into out there. I mean, it wasn't just nothing but predator tracks from side to side. I mean, you thought there was 1,000 coyotes running them down them washes.
Yeah. But anyway, so the next year, that guy's name was Kevin Sheff. I don't know where I think he lives in Colorado now. And we went out there, and we were trapping north of Wickenburg, a place called Alamo Lake, and it was the same year when Johnny Thorpe and Bud Boda came out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trapping basically the same area, but over a little bit from where we were at. And we ran into Bud Boda one day, but I never ran into Thorpe.
Mm-hmm.
We went out there the 1st of January, or the first part of January, and there wasn't any place we went where there hadn't been somebody trapping, but there was more predators than I'd ever seen. And we set traps, and we went back to start checking them. The first, I'll never forget this, because the first seven traps that I checked, I caught a canine in, and I thought, holy Toledo, who's going to skin all this stuff? It went downhill from there.
Yeah, it usually does.
Yeah. Either it's a good start or a bad finish, or vice versa.
But you went out there, what was it, like 2 years in a row, then skipped a year, then went out there again?
I'd have to think about that. I went out there with Kevin, and then I skipped a year. He came home, and he came home, packed his bag, and went back out, and he moved out there.
Huh.
And I think it was the next year that I went out there with John Headington.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you say out there in the desert and that you guys, tried to run? Because one of them guys was a good snare guy, was it Steve? And that just had you guys struggled with the snares, But you weren't.
You weren't
a snare guy. Kevin, anyway.
It was Kevin Sheff. He was infatuated. At that time, nobody was into snaring like they are now. Mm-hmm. I mean, mostly because it wasn't legal to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so. But he wanted the snare, and he was telling about he didn't even want to take traps. He just wanted to take snares out there. And I said, no, I ain't going nowhere without traps.
Yeah. Considering your traps.
Well, as it turned out, it wasn't that I knew any better, but it was a good thing we took the traps, because the snares when it come to, there was lots of tight places where you could set snares and stuff, and at that time I didn't know a whole lot about snaring too.
Mm-hmm.
And corn on it, they would go out of it. They'd go out of those washes and go around it.
Mm-hmm.
So the snaring, we didn't do too good on the snaring, but.
Well, when you're out there, like, you know, because I was like, I think I was 18 when we were out there, so my mind is different, but. But like, you know, being in Texas last year, they didn't have the sequoia cactuses and stuff like that. But with the mesquite and stuff, it was, you know, similar. But they didn't have the big washes. But you know, looking at them desert conditions, I mean, coming from like, you know, Alpena, Michigan, you know, with the cedar swamps and, you know, tight, everything's tight. Out there, it seems so wide open, you know, and it's hard. You know, when it's hard to pinpoint them. The locations.
Yeah. Arizona isn't so much like that. I mean, it's it's a lot of brush and stuff, but it's all the same. A lot, you know. I mean, there's, you know, that you can drive down the road and there's a dry wash. You know, you get out and walk up down the dry wash and find a place, go out down there and try to find a place to set a trap. You know, there's you know, it's kind of mind-boggling because the first time you go out there, there's so much sign, and it's hard. You know, you've never been in a situation like that. You don't really. It's hard to tell what's old and what's new.
Yeah.
You know, until after you've been there a year. You know, and it's like, I mean, I looked at coyote tracks in February, and then the 1st of January, they still. You know, I'm looking at the same coyote tracks.
Yeah, like 10 months later, 11 months later.
Yeah. Well, four weeks later, anyway.
Oh, 4 weeks. Oh, okay. I remember when we were out there, you tell me that you won't see them cats until, and I never seen it like that anywhere but out there, except for that one cat that we seen down there that you were videoing for me that day. It was hiding so good. But you... Out there, I remember I was right inside the catch circle, and, you know, I was 18 and, you know, thought I was bulletproof, but I was inside that catch circle, and I didn't see that cat, and I walked back outside the catch circle, and that cat just perfectly blended in with the background there. And you had told me, when you make eye contact with them cats, they'll know the jig's up. And when I did, man, that cat just exploded. That's one of the vivid memories I have about Arizona, that cat just blowing up at that set. As soon as, because I've seen... Them yellow eyes just like glaring back at me, and when we met eyes, that's when he popped. It's weird that they know that you know when that happens, but
they sure blend in. That's for sure.
But I mean, even in Texas, they didn't blend in like that. Maybe part of it was I was 18 years old and had my mind on women and everything else too.
Oh, well, I know.
Where now I'm more just single-minded.
I call that your outlaw years.
Outlaw year. I just work and sleep. I guess what we'll do is we'll wrap it up there and.
That was back when you still had coon dog shit in your blood too.
Yeah, but I had a blood transfusion and got all that out though.
Yeah, I know. That was good. I knew it.
Well, I knew you just have to get that one last little dig in. Something's never changed. Well, Clint will like that anyways. So, all right. Well, hey, thanks a lot for doing the interview. And, maybe if we get time, we'll do another one. We go into, because you got a lot of interesting history and a lot of interesting stories. And I enjoy listening to them just when we're talking, about buying fur for Hudson Bay. And,
when you get to this bay, that's what you got stories. So you better be making them.
Yep, that's true. I'm trying.
The money's all gone, and all you got is stories.
Yep.
The pictures.
Yep. Pictures and stories. That's where it's at.
Like I always told you about all these guys. These guys that all make these when they're talking about making these big catches, and that was one thing I always said that at the conventions. I say, where's the picture?
Yep. Even when I was a kid. You know, yeah, I remember you saying that.
if a trapper catches a whole bunch of stuff, he's going to take a picture of it.
Yep. Yep, he will.
Yeah. But,
this will be satisfied. What do you say? Skynyrd songs. I mean, when you think of 30 years, you know, there's just so many great ones. So we're going to get in as many as we can tonight. We thank you so much for coming. You guys got to keep going with us. Give us the power. We've been there. We've done that. And we ain't never going back again.